Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Experience summer comfort for less. Explore our sale on curtains and bedding. Perfect time to update and freshen your home.
We've Owen Cleary on the line. Owen, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for getting in touch, Owen. So you are a teacher among many other different achievements and roles that you have, and you are very concerned about a new L'Oreal ad. Well, it's actually Urban Decay, but they're under the brand of L'Oreal. Can you tell me what's your concern?
Yeah, I'm just really angry on behalf of my students, particularly my female teenage students who are being bombarded with so much stuff and having to deal with so much stuff on social media at the moment, particularly explicit adults and pornographic content. And now L'Oreal have decided to hire a sexually explicit porn content creator from OnlyFans to target teenagers on TikTok and Instagram with this new line of makeup. And it's not okay. And we should be doing something about it.
So the lady you're talking about, her name is Ori Kitsia. And can you tell me a little bit about her then? Because she has a couple of different roles herself, doesn't she?
Yeah, so basically she's a sexually explicit content creator on OnlyFans, as well as a massive teen influencer on platforms like TikTok and Instagram, where she has over 4.6 million followers. And L'Oreal have hired her to be the new face of their Urban Decay line of makeup that targeted at young women and teenage girls, and it already has 18 followers. The last I heard, it had 18.7 million views. But I suppose it's important to say that this isn't about what Ori does, you know, for a living. It isn't about shaming her for her for what she does online, and it's about calling out L'Oreal for targeting teenagers with this kind of content. And I suppose it's important to say as well that it isn't just Ori Kitsia. It's ask any teen or tween girl or boy in your life who the Bop House girls are, and they'll tell you. I didn't know who they were until my 14 and 15 year old students introduced me to them. They're a group of young women who live together in a porn production mansion in Florida, and again, they create two types of content. The first is for TikTok with Get Ready For Me videos or funny dances or trends or makeup tutorials, but they're also all OnlyFans content creators with adult channels, and they provide pornographic content. And now by hiring Ori Kitsia, L'Oreal are taking advantage of this TikTok to OnlyFans pipeline, funneling kids' engagement from one to the other. And that might sound alarmist or an exaggeration, but it isn't. It's the business model. OnlyFans requires you to promote yourself on other social media platforms. And for every referral you get, you make 5% of the income generated by them on OnlyFans. So if you can become a teen influencer on TikTok and glamorize the life of selling your body for sex online, even if a tiny fraction of your followers decides to do the same, you get a cut of their earnings and get rich. And this is just part of a concerted campaign by the porn industry to rebrand the sex trade to kids by youthifying it and cutifying it. And it's all about bop girls and mattress actresses, where the reality is it's mining the world for those it can make the most money out of. And just as in many other parts of the sex trade, in reality, that's almost entirely vulnerable and marginalized women and children. Okay. And now L'Oreal are giving the porn industry a massive boost in this campaign by normalizing and glamorizing the industry for them. And they're being congratulated for doing so.
Okay, well, we have asked, we've put a number of different questions into L'Oreal over the last couple of days to ask them about some of your concerns that you're raising here, Owen. We haven't heard back from them, but I do have a statement that they gave to The Guardian, I think, last weekend. And I might bring that to you in a second. But just firstly, we might go back to the ad that is actually has been put out there, the one in which Ori Kitsia is featuring. Well, she's actually on the Instagram account, on the Urban Decay Instagram account, in a number of different places, but there's this one in particular, the one that you've mentioned, which has been seen almost 20 million times. And in it, there's a tagline which says UD, that's Urban Decay, UD likes it raw. It says censorship is out of control. It calls for uncensored makeup that performs on stage, on camera, and yes, on mattresses. And the mattresses, I think, Owen, is a reference to what you're talking about there, the mattress actress, which is a porn star. That's another word for it. I think we have actually a clip of the ad. We might just have a listen to it, if you don't mind. Let's have a listen.
Sure.
I think it's coming up now.
Breaking news. We interrupt your scrolls with an urgent message. We are in a blandemic. Wasn't makeup made to perform on stage, on camera, and yes, on mattresses? Censorship is out of control. Coming for my content? What really needs to be canceled? Boring makeup. I'm not afraid to go all the way. But it seems like the world is. No glitter, no individuality, no expression. It's giving basic, not Bob. 15 steps for a barely there look. I mean, I've starred in roles with less coverage than that. It's time to end this plague of dry because I'm not turned on and neither are you. Let's blur the bland, bleep the boring, and bring uncensored makeup back to center stage.
This has been a public service announcement from the Urban Decay Anti-Bland Broadcast.
Yeah, so that's the ad, Owen, right? And I found it really interesting when I was watching it because my initial reaction was, you know, is there really anything there? And then, listeners might have missed it, and I definitely missed it first time round, that one of the mentions she makes there, it's giving basic, not bop. Now, I didn't know anything about the bop house that you're talking about, but you're telling me the bop house, which is this house in which porn creators live and also do content on makeup content and things like that on other platforms. The bop house is very well known among teenage girls, so they get that reference straight away.
Absolutely. And I suppose when you see the ad, and I was like you, I didn't find it particularly inappropriate at first, but it's only when you realize the relationship that teenage girls have with this person already on TikTok. And that's problematic in itself. And they already know what she does for a living. They know how she makes all her money because she promotes it in all of her material, as do the bop girls. In the bop house, another thing that I had no idea about until my 14 and 15 year old students introduced me to. But
when you say your 14 and 15 year old students introduced you to it, like what are they telling you about it? What's their perception of it?
So I teach SPHE in secondary school, and thankfully now we're able to talk about things like the impact of social media on them, the impact of sexualization on them, their experience of being exposed to porn online. And through those discussions, they asked me, do you know who the bop house girls are? And I had no idea. And I asked them, no, explain to me who they are. And immediately they became embarrassed and said, oh, look them up for yourself. So then I knew immediately what was going on. And I did look them up. And I mean, what they produce on Instagram and TikTok is very innocent. But it's that they're glamorizing the life of what they do on their other platforms. That's a problem when it's targeting teen girls. Yeah. And again, this is not, I'm very conscious that I'm a male voice talking about what women do to make money. And this is not about shaming that at all or shaming any woman that is involved in that industry. It's about the targeting or grooming of teenagers into this world from a very early age. That's the issue.
Okay, well, we actually do have a female voice in the line, and I want to bring Martina in on this. Martina, you're very welcome to the programme. What do you think about all this?
Hi, Sarah. Yeah, thanks for having me on. Yeah, I'm absolutely appalled and very, very angry, to be honest. So I read about that this appointment by Urban Decay about a week ago or whatever, and I couldn't believe my eyes, to be honest with you. Like, I just think, as Owen said there, it's completely glamorising the sex trade for young teenagers. And just to be clear, it won't be just teenage girls seeing this, it'll also be younger girls. And we know from, I've done a bit of reading on the whole topic of internet safety and how porn and other things are being served up to teenagers on social media and all the rest of it. And I just think that, you know, this is all more of the same thing. It's just totally trying to normalise pornography and bring it into the mainstream. And that might not be that problematic, except that it's trying to entice young girls and teenagers into it. But the pornography today is largely really misogynistic and anti-woman. And it's basically showing acts of aggression against women. That, like, for your listeners who aren't familiar with this, the porn today is shocking. Like, it's really
violent.
It's really harmful and violent. That's what is being watched overwhelmingly. It's not just on the fringe. That's what most porn is today. And it's also leading, we know, from things that our own Garda Commissioner has said and the UK Police Commissioner, that it's leading to increases in gender-based violence. Mm-hmm. Drew Harris said that it's radicalising young men into violence against women, some young men. We know it's leading to increases in child sexual abuse because it's driving an appetite to the extremes. And we know that it's also leading to increases in child-on-child incest.
Okay.
Now,
I need to stop you there for a second, because we've taken a big leap, haven't we, from, you know, an ad that's promoting makeup to what you're talking about there, Martine. And I understand the steps that you're taking, but just one second now. I want to give the L'Oreal response that L'Oreal gave this to The Guardian. Like I said, this programme has been in touch with the company. We've sent them a number of different queries. We haven't heard back. We would love to hear back from them. We'll be able to talk to them or give their response on the programme today if they would like to send that in. It's liveline@rte.ie, or it's 51551, or it's 0818715815. But this is the response that they gave to The Guardian. They said that Urban Decay partners with a diverse range of talent to represent the many facets of creative expression. Urban Decay chose US creator Oria Kizia for her distinctive makeup artistry and her authenticity. She's known for her open and transparent dialogue with her community, fostering conversations about her personal experiences, including the joys, the challenges and the risks of the industry she works in. So I wonder what you think of that. I might maybe put that to your cell phone first. What do you think of that? That's their response.
Yeah, the links between the porn industry and sex trafficking and the sex trade are well documented and well made. And I'd like to invite L'Oreal to interview any of the migrant women here who've been trafficked into the sex trade in Dublin on the joys, challenges and risks of the same industry that they've been forced into, and use that to promote their Urban Decay makeup line to teenagers and see how they get on.
Okay, and in terms of what Oria Kizia is saying, because this is sort of to your point, Martina, and also your point, Owen, that a lot of the time what a lot of these content creators are doing is they're on the Instagram or TikTok platform promoting makeup or Get Ready With Me videos, but in the context of doing that, they're also talking about their other work. And for example, Oria Kizia would be talking about the advantages of going into the adult content creation industry on TikTok, promising her followers on TikTok that it can prove to be a lucrative career choice. Like, for example, one of the things she said is, the thing about my job is if you go full out, you can make enough money to start your own thing, whether that's buying houses or doing Airbnbs and investing. So I suppose that is really, I suppose, Martina saying, you know, this is something you should look into.
Absolutely, yeah. It's basically saying, don't bother studying hard or working hard or anything like that, because really what's of most interest to you or about you is your body and what you're prepared to do on screen for the satisfaction of men around the world. And that's men of all ages and all descriptions all around the world. And I think that is a really bleak, depressing and sad message to be sending young girls. And I just don't understand how any big brand name who professes to have, no doubt, value statements and all the rest of it could be associated with that.
Yeah. Like, they do have values, and we took a look at on their website, and this is one of the queries that we've put to L'Oreal specifically in relation to this, because they say on their website, under their values and how they work with influencers, that they commit to not posting, that influencers and content creators have to give these commitments, that to commit to not posting or previously posted content which is at odds with our values of respect, tolerance and inclusion. L'Oreal say, in particular, partners will not share views or engage in behaviours which could be interpreted as racism, homophobia, misogyny, religious intolerance, violence, hateful content, bullying or aggressiveness towards others, pornography or any other type of criminal activity. So we did ask L'Oreal, how does hiring an OnlyFans worker who creates and promotes pornography adhere to those values that it has on the website?
Yeah. Good question. Yeah, and I hope that they just cancel this campaign entirely.
Yeah. Martina, can I ask you, do you have any young women in your life? You know, do you see people who are being maybe affected by this, or that you'll be concerned will be affected by this?
I have a daughter who's about to turn 14, and I've been very careful about what I allow her to see. So she's not really on social media, to be honest with you. But regardless of being on social media or not, she has access to YouTube, let's say, right? Mm. Which is just as bad as all the rest of them, really. But I'm careful about what she watches. But as Owen said there, they are bombarded from the word go with beauty, and how you look and how to make yourself, optimize yourself in every single way. So yeah, she's starting to wear makeup now, and just experimenting with it and all of that kind of innocent, harmless stuff, which is why I find this such a cynical exercise by a teenage makeup brand. I just think it's appalling.
And do you think there's any way, really, you can protect her from it? I mean, I know you're saying you've done what you can in terms of keeping her away from it, but I mean, they get to an age, don't they, where that's not possible. So it's going to come at her.
I think that, personally, I think, Sarah, that everybody needs to be talking about this porn thing. We need to expose this, right? And we need to start talking to all the young people in our lives. And I would say every responsible adult, be that parents, grandparents, whoever. Personally, I just think we need to blow the cover on this thing because it's going on in the background. And tons of your listeners have no idea the volumes of this stuff that's coming out and is being viewed by our young people, deliberately being targeted with this stuff, okay? So personally, I think we all need to be having this conversation and saying, is this what we want our young people to be watching and why it's not okay? And it's not okay for all those reasons I spoke to earlier, right? I don't care if two people are watching consensual, respectful sex. I'm not here to pass judgment on that, but that's not what the majority of this stuff is.
Yeah, well, no, the pornography, is very violent that people are watching now. And indeed, I've spoken to people on Drive Time, doctors on Drive Time, who say that they are now seeing young women who are coming in with bruises around their throats because that's the way both young women and men think they should be having sex, because they're growing up learning how to have sex through porn, violent pornography. And young women are consenting to this and then coming in actually injured, you know, as a result of it. So that's where we're at the moment,
Sarah,
folks. Just in case you're not aware, that is actually where we're at in 2025. Owen, go on.
Just to come in on that, Sarah, directly due to its introduction into porn, strangulation, known in porn as choking or breath play, now accounts for the second most common cause of stroke in young women under 40. And because it's so dangerous and yet so normalised in porn, in Ireland in 2023, we had to pass legislation to outlaw it. And there's been 67 prosecutions since then. But young people are being groomed to do it online. And you're right, this is where we're at. There are tens of thousands of pieces of advice on TikTok and other social media platforms on how to choke someone safely. And it's really important to say, for anybody listening out there who might be relying on porn to inform what they think is expected of them in sex, it's not choking, it's strangulation, and there's no safe way to do it.
Okay. I just want to say again, because I'm very conscious we haven't got a comment from L'Oreal yet on this, right? L'Oreal is not promoting any of that. Okay, what L'Oreal is doing is using a star who is on TikTok and is selling makeup, but also has an OnlyFans account. And I understand the point that you're making is that it's a gateway into the OnlyFans world where you can then access perhaps this other type of very dangerous porn. But that is not where L'Oreal is at, and it's nowhere near that. And again, I would love to hear from the company on it. Can I ask you, Owen, separately? It's not separately, but it's related. If I can go back to the Bop House for a second, and you know, Martina's there and she's trying to protect her daughter, and so many other people will be trying to protect their daughters and their sons. But it reminds me of the controversy over the very powerful Netflix program Adolescence, where there was a different language being spoken by teenagers, so parents didn't understand literally what was happening in terms of the emojis and the different sort of words that were being used. So they didn't understand what was actually being said. So how do parents get, you know, protect their kids? When, like, if I had heard my kids talking about Bop House, I wouldn't have had a clue what they were talking about.
Yeah, I suppose we have to be so curious, and that's the key. We need to come at this with curiosity for our young people, because they know we're not the experts in this area. So we need to engage with them and what they're engaging with online and be curious about it. But really, to be honest, Sarah, at this stage, it shouldn't be up to parents and it shouldn't be up to children to learn how to protect themselves online, or it shouldn't be up to parents to learn how to protect their children online. The government should be stepping in to age verify anything that is not appropriate for children to be engaging with, so that we can let our children go online with the knowledge that they're going to be safe and they're not going to come across any of this material. And that has recently been made legally possible. The EU just came out with its recommendations on Article 28 of the DS, on the Digital Services Act, which allows nation states, independent nation states, to put through their own age verification. So, and I hate to call him out because he's my local politician, but I see Simon Harris on Instagram every second week saying how upset he is and how concerned he is about what's happening to kids on Instagram. but he has the power to legislate against it. Why do we not have age verification?
Okay, well, I know
it
the government...
It's possible.
Yeah. I don't know exactly where that's at, to be honest. I don't have that information to hand, but I do know it is something that the government says that they're... I mean, Micheál Martin has said it's one of the issues of our time is children's access to the internet.
Well, France are putting it in place. Yeah, Germany are putting in place. Austria is putting in place. Greece is putting in place. Where are we on that?
Okay, well, maybe I might try and get the updated situation on that, because I don't have it to hand. Like I said, it's just in the back of my head, but not clear enough in the back of my head for me to say it. Martina, yes, I have a couple of people on the line, but Martina, go on ahead and then I'll get to some of our other callers.
Sorry, I know I've taken up a lot of your time.
You're
fine. I just want to make one final point. For anyone who's as appalled by this as we are, could I ask them to send an email complaint, which I did, to customerservice@support.urbandecay.com, and also maybe also to Boots Ireland, Arnott's and Next, who are stocking Urban Decay. There are also a lot of online retailers, but if we targeted those big names,
you can get it anywhere, really,
can't
you?
Difference.
Yeah, but okay, that's fair enough. Mary Davies is on the line. Mary.
Hello, Sarah.
Hello, and thank you for getting in touch.
Yeah. I'm older than the people you've had on. I'm a grandparent, and I'd love to say that I applaud Owen very, very much and Martina for sticking their heads above the parapet, because in the recent past, it's been very, very difficult to call out what's just not acceptable, because the kind of level of unacceptability has been kind of fudged and blurred. But I think, you know what, there's a little bit of movement. I read it in the papers, and the word curiosity there, I'm very, very curious about all things. But this thing is something that it's time to say, shout stop, time to call halt. And I have to say that I was in another life, I was a teacher, and Owen is very brave. And I'm sure he has huge, huge support, because among my own contemporaries and people younger with whom I mix, a lot of them are nearly afraid to talk and say, you know, this is not acceptable. And there are things that at this stage are just not, on a human level, just not acceptable.
And what is it, Mary, specifically that you would have concerns about? Or is there something specifically, or is it just a general trend that you're worried about?
The general trend, definitely I'm worried about, but Martina there has alluded to very specific things in relation to youngsters and the targeting of youngsters, which is, it's cynical, and there is double speak too among maybe companies, maybe government people as well, government ministers. Mm. It's time to kind of say, come on now, it's time to stop and give us a break from what is naked exploitation, naked sexploitation, and all that happens along those lines.
Okay.
So I'm just saying to Owen and to Martina, keep it going. Keep the ball running and keep it going, because you have a tremendous support. I would imagine.
It's a conversation that needs to happen, isn't it, Mary? It's a conversation that we all need to be having, I think, a lot more than we are having in order to protect our children. Paul is on the line. And Paul, you're very welcome. You're in a secondary school as well, is that right?
That's correct, yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for getting in touch. So what's your point, or what do you think about all of this?
Yeah, I just wanted to reiterate what your guys were saying there, especially Owen. I work kind of face to face with students, and I know probably they'd be getting a lot of text messages and phone calls from listeners out there. But from my perspective, sadly, not to be the bearer of bad news, but I firmly believe we are seeing the tip of the iceberg when it comes to these issues. As I said, I work in a secondary school. I meet with students one-to-one every single day. I've met with hundreds of students every year. Majority of them are young girls and boys. And every week I have young kind of 13 to 16-year-old girls in my office crying because what's expected of them in relationship and the things that they have done are what's expected them to be done, as well as boys, what's expected of them. I think we've taken a turn because they're no longer embarrassed to talk about it. They're actually coming to my office pleading the schools and people around them to do something about it.
Really?
They know it's wrong. They kind of just get embarrassed what they're doing, but they don't know what to do. I've had boys, 17-year-old boys, last year. Obviously, I won't go into any details, but it's not just a once-off. I've had young men ask me advice about taking Viagra because they can no longer get sexually aroused in a normal relationship. 16, 17-year-old boys taking Viagra because of what they've witnessed for years of watching pornography. And unfortunately, when you hear this on the radio, you might think it's been exaggerated. You might think it's this. I'm telling the listeners, I am dealing with this every single day. And this is the tip of the iceberg. And the stories that I'm hearing into primary schools coming into secondary schools are getting worse. This year, I know it's going to be busier than it was last year because it's just a trend. And it's hard to listen to it. But when you see when you're face to face with young teenagers, you might think it's hard to listen to the radio, but I'm telling you, there's a brokenness when it comes to sitting with these young people, and they're desperate for help. They're literally in my office crying for looking for help to know what to do. They're looking for advice. They're looking for more classes. They're looking for the government. There's an addiction. If it was addicted to drugs, there'd be so many helpline services to help. And the young boys don't know what to do because they are watching pornography 8-9 times a week at the minimum, some of these young boys.
Paul, I don't even know what to say, because, we hear this from the experts that this is happening, but just to hear that firsthand, what you are dealing with and what these young people are dealing with and the state they find themselves in before they're even out of school.
Yeah.
And when you say they're asking for help, what, and it's a porn addiction that you're seeing, is it?
I see in two angles. I see a lot of young men, I guess, would say that they are openly addicted. I think it's amazing that I have the privilege. It is my dream job. It's a privilege that they feel like they can open up to me and talk about it. There's a huge amount of addiction when it comes to pornography. And the type that when I talk about addiction, I teach about it a little bit. And I talk about the types of pornography and how addiction works and the type of pornography you're watching and why these porn sites and social media are getting more aggressive, more graphic. It's to increase your addiction and dopamine levels into it. And they know that. And they're worried about the type of things that is turning them on. They know it's not normal. They know it's wrong, but they can't help themselves. And then that happens with the young girls too. Education, they educate themselves because they're not getting enough education when it comes to it. And I believe parents feel a lot of the time, not all parents, but they feel too awkward, too scared. They want to be cool parents, they want to be with them, but they don't want to talk about it. And the young girls are coming to me and they're in tears and they're going, and I asked a young female student, she was doing a project and she gave it to me to read and told me to not pass it on, but she didn't mind me talking about it. And at the very end, it talked about what's expected of her in relationships and what her body should look like. I'm not going to go into too much detail on the radio, but what her body should look like. You can join the dots in a certain way, and how males have this, the young, her kind of classmates have this idea of what she should look like and what she should do in a relationship. And if they don't do it, then they are ostracized, and they are, there's rumors on Snapchat that's sent around to them and they don't have any attention. And at the very end of this long project, the last few words were said, please help. And the idea that she sent this to me, she said, I actually don't mind, this is going to embarrass me, but I don't mind you using this project because I don't want younger girls having to deal with, I've made mistakes and I don't want younger 8, 9, 10 year olds having to do what I did. And she's made, there's a lot of students that have just made so many regrets. And I just, as I say, it's a lot. I deal with it face to face. But unless the government and everybody stands up to it, we have a massive issue on our hands. And I always tell the students, it reminds me of when the smoking companies used to advertise smoking as a healthy habit. They used to advertise, they even had cigarettes for asthmatics because they believed it was healthy and it released stress. And I think it wasn't until people joined the dots together and say, well, there's a serious health concern. I think we're at the stage where we're starting to see it. But the truth is, we're only just at the brink of it. We're not actually seeing.
And I think probably, Paul, and I don't know if this is part of the work that you're doing, but probably most parents have no idea what their children are seeing or if their children have seen anything online, because it's so easy to access. And in a lot of instances, children are not talking about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a lot of parents saying, well, not my innocent little Jimmy, he would never do that. That's not him. All his friends would. But like, I'm pretty blunt when it comes to it. So if you hand your child a phone and you let their child go into their bedroom on their own with their phone, I mean, there's no excuse for that. I mean, that is just like, it's like handing a heroin addict a bag of heroin and going to their bedroom and say, don't take it. That's what it sounds like to me. It's completely naive to hand your child a phone in their bedroom on their own and just let them have free reign.
And what help can you give to the children who are coming to you? What help, if the entire sort of teenage ecosystem is set up like this, as you're describing, that there are expectations, that everyone's aware of the expectations, that they're sharing those expectations on Snapchat or whatever the platform is, and that you're ostracised if you don't live up to whatever you're meant to look like or whatever you're meant to do sexually, if you're not doing all that, then you're ostracized. How do you help them out of that?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I the only thing I can hope is that I do help them in some way by having conversations, giving them a safe place to talk in security. And a lot of time that is, you know, it's a healing process when they start to talk about this in a kind of a safe environment. And that's, as I said, my privilege to do. In the classes, I give a lot of talks on kind of, and I give an opportunity for the males and females to sit down, we sit in a circle and we talk about it. And, you know, we write down our expectations and we learn that actually it's not just the guy's expectations of the females. And it's, and then we talk about the expectations of males, and it's all of a sudden you start to realize that that's not actually true. And where is this coming from? If the boys are saying that they don't expect this of the girls, and the girls are saying they don't expect, so where are they getting this information from, and why are they believing it?
Yeah.
But I just think having a conversation is the start, I believe.
Yeah. And Martina, I wonder what you think about all that as the mother of a 14-year-old.
Yeah, it's basically a hellscape, isn't it? Like, it's so, I'm so sad. Like, I feel so sorry. I do feel we've let them down, I have to say. And I feel our politicians and our media commissioner, Cathal Sheehan, they have the power to act on this. And the time for excuses is over now. And probably based on is a poll, that powerful testimony there from Paul, based on what he's saying there, it sounds like we need an enormous, apart from regulation and stopping people getting access to this stuff, we need a huge education exercise around pornography and what real sexual relations look like. And it actually goes way beyond consent, as far as I'm concerned. It's about respect, and it's about both parties getting a lot from a relationship, sexual relationship, not just consenting to something. You know, girls are consenting to things all the time that they don't necessarily want to do, or that isn't, you know,
they think this is the expectation. This is what happens because that's what they're learning.
So exactly. So they're consenting, but they shouldn't be consenting.
Yeah, the expectation is I should be choked and I should want to be choked, and therefore I will let that happen. And I should enjoy it. I don't enjoy it, but I should enjoy
it. Various other things.
Yes, or various other things. Yeah, exactly. Giving examples. Because doctors are screaming about it, you know, and they've been screaming about it for the last couple of years to sort of say, you know, they're ringing the alarm bells very loud and clear that there's a big, big issue here that we're just not looking at and we're not talking about. Owen, just maybe a final word to yourself. I don't know what you think about the conversation that we've had thus far.
I want to say to Paul how amazing the work he's doing is. It's the same work that I've been doing in my school. And I normally speak from a place of anger when I'm talking about it in the media, because when I talk about the actual students that sit in front of me, it just upsets me. And I'm sitting here with tears in my eyes with relief that students have people like Paul in their school, because I think so many of us are doing this work in the schools, But we're not talking to each other about it, and we're not supporting each other in it. And we need to have a national conversation about porn and the impact that it's having on young people. 1 in 10 9-year-olds are being exposed to porn in primary school. They're being targeted with it. No 9-year-old goes looking for porn online. They don't want to see it. I was just at a national youth conference where it was very clear that one of the things they said is they don't want to see porn online. They don't want to be targeted. And if I could, or if Paul could just provide any, which he did so well, but if we could hear the voices of our students and if we could put them on the radio, this would be solved so quickly, because like Paul, I hear people, one of the first people I ever engaged with in the school when I became a teacher disclosed to me that she was sexually assaulted at a party, and And after supporting her and after doing all the obligatory reports that we had to do, I asked her, look, is there anything else that I can do for you? And she said, please just teach us about it. Talk to the guys and talk to the girls about the stuff they're seeing and let them figure out for themselves what they want from a relationship. And as part of the program I teach, we do a session on where the kids get to decide what they actually want from a sexual encounter. And none of it is pornified. And they're all so relieved to hear each other say, you know, how excited they want to be and how respectful they want to be and how loving they want to be when it comes to engaging sexually with somebody else. But that's not the message that they're being fed online. And we need to protect them from it, and we need to create a space where they can talk. But we need to talk about it as a country, because it's not just our teenagers. It's our entire, like 64% of 20-year-olds are using porn. 86% of 16 to 18-year-old boys are relying on it. This is a mass, and it is feeding into gender-based violence and sexual violence. We hear in the calls to the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre all the time, there's an increase of pornified expectations, and people are starting to name porn in those calls as informing what they've been forced to do when they ring in for help.
Okay.
So this is it's a massive issue.
Yeah, and indeed we had a text in from one listener who's not in a position to talk on air, but this person says, we have an adult son in his 20s. He's mild learning difficulties and is very vulnerable, and he's spent hundreds of euro on these sites. The problem is not only restricted to teenagers, which is a point you've just made yourself their own. Talk to your kids, folks. Talk to your teenagers. Talk to your children. Talk to your adult children. And let's get the conversation going. Owen, thank you so much for calling us to bring up the whole issue, I suppose, and thank you all for getting in touch, Paul and Martina, and thank you all for getting in touch with your thoughts on it. 51551.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815.
Now, Sarah O'Mahony joins us on the line, and Sarah, you're very welcome to the programme this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, thanks for joining us. You have had an awful time recently because you saved up for a bike. Tell me what happened.
Okay, so I was in the city centre and I was going to my friend's flat, and I had locked my bike up outside of a bank, which I thought would be a good idea because there's loads of cameras. I left it on a bike rack as well. And I came out 2 hours later to go home. Bike is gone. Lock is on the ground.
What time in the day was that?
It was actually in the morning. It was at like 7 o'clock in the morning. I realised it was gone.
Okay. And tell me about the bike, because you had saved up for this bike, had you, for a while?
I did. So I was working a summer job and I was actually saving up for it for like 2 months, because I was like, oh, this will make it easier to go to college. And it did, because public transport, it just takes forever for me to get anywhere.
Hmm.
Because I live like next to loads of schools, and like in the morning, trying to get to college at that time, it takes way too long. And it was just more convenient for me to get a bike to get around.
So how much did it cost you, do you mind me asking?
Almost 900.
Oof, right, okay.
And like, for me, that is quite the spend. I wouldn't be making extreme purchases like that, so...
Yeah, it's quite the spend for anyone, I mean, but you're a student. 900 euros is an awful lot of money for a student. So you came out, the bike was gone, the lock was on the ground. Was it a good lock? You know, I know you can get different types of locks. Not that it's your fault if it wasn't a good lock, but like, I don't know, had you bothered? Like my husband actually, as it happens, has an electric bike and I can't even lift the lock. It's so heavy because he's just so frightened of this happening to him. Like, what sort of lock did you have?
Like, it's a steel wire lock and it's wrapped in this plastic stuff. It came with the bike, so I assumed it was okay.
Okay.
It wasn't cut or anything. It was kicked off. Like, the part where you put the key in was just on the ground. The rest of it was gone because you can't cut it.
Okay. Okay.
So unless you really tried.
And what did you do? Did you try the guards?
Oh, yeah, no, I rang the guards like straight away and they were like, oh, you should come in and make a statement. And I did. But I don't know where that's going to go.
Because they have no real way of finding it. What about the cameras, I suppose? You don't know, I suppose. You don't know whether or not they can find anyone on the cameras.
Yeah, like, I'm still, like, talking to them at the moment and I'm going to mention the cameras again and be like, can you check symptoms, please.
Okay, Sarah, stay with
but
us.
But in broad daylight, it is daft.
Yeah, but no one seemed to have seen anything. Sarah, stay with us if you don't mind, because we have your friend actually on the line, Sophia. And Sophia, you're very welcome. You're studying art as well with Sarah in Cork, in Crawford Art College. And you had your bike stolen.
Yeah, it was the exact same kind of bike too. Like, my story was that it was last Thursday. I was going into work. So I had work at 1:00. I locked up the bike at like, I think it was around 12:30. I want to say maybe 2 minutes from like where I work on Grand Parade. So that's like the middle of the city. It's like, you can't have more people there. So I went into work. I came back for my break. I came out to get food for my break at around 4:30. And I checked on my bike, my noble steed, and it was just gone. Like, it just was not there. And I was just like, the worst part was that, like, 30-minute break, I did not have time to mourn my bike. It was just awful. It was not a nice feeling.
Oh, so you had to go back into work knowing it was gone.
Yeah, I mean, my managers were lovely. Like, they were really nice to me. They were like, obviously, take a bit longer if you want. And they were just saying, like, send us pictures of your bike. Like, obviously, all our coworkers will try and just have a look out for it. But, I mean, there's not really much you can do, to be honest.
Yeah. And so you came at 4:30 and you're saying this is in city centre location. So really somebody somewhere must have seen this happen.
Yeah, like, that's what I was thinking, you know, because the thing with me, though, is, like, Sarah, her lock was on the ground. My lock wasn't. Like, as in, everything was gone. My lock, the bike, my helmet. Like, there was no traces left, you know?
Okay. And had you been saving up for this as well? Or, you know, where does that leave you now in terms of getting around?
I mean, it was actually a gift from my dad. My dad got it for me. Like, I want to say probably a year prior to that. And it's like, obviously, I can take the bus, but I don't think I have to tell you, like, the absolute state of our public transport system. Like, it's not great. I would have to leave maybe an hour and a half early to go to work, when before I could get on that bike, I'd say 15 minutes before my shift and still be early.
Okay.
You know, so
it's mad, really, the two of you, friends with electric bikes in the same area, both having them stolen, you know, I mean, and, you know, gone, disappeared in broad daylight. Stay with us, Sophia, as well, if you don't mind. We've Eric on the line. Eric, you're very welcome. Eric Conroy, you had your bike stolen. This is in Dublin, is it?
That's right, Dublin last year on the Keys. Yeah, my electric bike. I've had a few bikes stolen over the years, but this was an electric bike and I was really shocked, you know, so we just need to be very careful about our electric bikes, you know, and maybe have a second-hand, cheaper bike for around town where you feel it might be unsafe. But it's an awful shock to the system to have your bike stolen. It's a part of your personality, and having to trudge to the Garda station, give all the details, and then walk home and maybe think where the bike would have gone. It's a real shock to the system, and hopefully we can do something about it, but very few bikes seem to be recovered.
Yeah, it's a horrible thing to happen, isn't it? It's a really horrible thing to happen. And your own bike, was it expensive, Eric?
It was expensive. It was 2,500. Oh. You know, it was a Bosch e-bike. I had it insured, and I got some funds back on it, and the funds enabled me to get a second-hand electric bike. So I sort of landed on my feet financially, but it doesn't get away from the shock of the initial of the robbery and the aftermath.
Yeah, and the Keys in Dublin, again, a very busy part of the country. You know, people going the time up
you
and down the Keys.
You need to be very careful on the Keys, where it's isolated. You should try and go off-road, go into an institution or lock it where there's plenty of other bikes. There are ways and means to minimise it, and not to have a very expensive bike, expensive looking bike, but you have to have a bike from time to time.
It's a sad state of affairs, isn't it, that you have a lovely bike and you think, well, I can't cycle that into the city now because it won't be safe.
Yes, that's my attitude now, and I'm just very, very careful where I cycle it to, the electric bike.
Right.
And as I say, very few bikes are recovered, and I'm wondering about this. Why is there a very poor detection rate on bikes? are they whisked out of the country? I looked around for my, because the my bike had no, I took the computer off the handlebars, which helps, should help. It means the bike, that bike can't be cycled in electric mode. But there was no sign of the bike that it was abandoned because they couldn't cycle it.
Okay.
They must have had some way of getting electric getting it away, on the bike. Yeah.
And did you, you had it locked, obviously. How did they get
it? I had a kryptonite lock, and I had the back wheel immobilized, and I said I took the computer off the handlebars. With my new bike, with my second-hand bike, the people who sold it to me were thankful. they gave me a spare set of locks, an extra lock. So that would be my advice, is to have maybe two locks. And then if the thieves are coming down looking to steal a bike, if they see a bike with two locks, they might think, well, let's go on to the next bike.
Yeah, just make it as unappealing as possible, basically, is your best bet. Sort of like when you set your house up with the alarm on the outside, just make it, even if it looks like there's an alarm, just make it look like there's an alarm. No, of course, you should also always have an alarm if you can at all. Michael's on the line. Michael, you're welcome. You've had a bad experience yourself.
Yes. I went to an orienteering event in Cabinteely Woods, Cabinteely Park, on the 17th of June this year. I met an old friend of mine who I hadn't met since college days for 41 years. And I did the orienteering event, which was kind of a whole new ball game because I had to wear glasses to see the map. Which wasn't very conducive to orienteering.
Okay.
But anyway, I came out, the long and the short of it, I came out and found my bike gone that I had locked at one of those bike stands.
Okay.
You know, the upside down U's that are in the ground.
Yeah.
So the bike was gone, and I concur with that feeling of the bottom falling out of your world that the other guy mentioned just a few minutes ago. I just felt awful.
So did you try the guards? Go on, you did. You went to Cabinteely Garda Station. Okay, go on.
Garda Station, reported it, and then made a couple of phone calls to the same Vanguard over the month. But I kept checking Done Deal. Oh. And 1 month later, on the 16th of July, I saw my bike.
No.
This ends up as a happy story. I called the Cabinteely Garda Station. They had a look at the ad and they called me back and said, it's on sale in Portlaoise. We'll meet you in Portlaoise in an hour. So luckily I had the loan of my best friend's car for the week. I'm here from Argentina. I'm helping my mother, who's 100 years old, and she's very unable.
Okay.
And she was going to a medical appointment, and my best friend lent me a car for a week, and I had a car, luckily enough. So I met the guards in Portlaoise, and they put me in their Garda car. They drove around to the estate where the bike was. And they said, you wait in the car. So I waited in the car like a good boy. And they went off and they came back with my bike in about 10 minutes. I said, what happened? They said, this guy wasn't the thief. He bought it from the thief. But we confiscated it from him. We told him you shouldn't be buying stolen goods.
Okay.
So he bought it for like 200. He was selling it for 400 online. On the Done Deal site.
So you got your bike back. Well, that is wonderful, Michael. That is a good story.
I got it back. Yeah.
So that's,
I got it back.
That's great. I'm delighted for you. Eric, did you keep an eye on any websites like that? Or
not really, no. Maybe I should have done it. I haven't. Maybe occasionally I would have done, but not in a systematic way.
Yeah.
But it's a fair point. I know there's an issue about a tracker. My friend would have a tracker on their bike. And I gather you can track bikes that way if they're stolen. It costs about €400, but that's something to bear in mind maybe on an expensive bike or a reasonably priced bike.
Okay.
I didn't have a tracker on my bike.
Okay, well, listen, thank you all very much for getting in touch with your stories. And Sarah and Sophia, maybe it might be worth it as well looking online. You never know what might turn up there. If you have any thoughts on this, if you have any stories you'd like to share, 51551.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815.
Now, Munro Rurock is on the line. And Munro, you're very welcome to the programme this afternoon.
Good afternoon, Sarah. How are you today?
I'm good, and thank you so much for getting in touch. You got in touch with the programme because you were listening to discussions we were having earlier in the week about cochlear implants and Specsaver ads and all of that. Is that right?
Yes, that's exactly it.
Okay.
I was listening back to it. And just the listening to the part about the cochlear implants, it kind of very resonated quite highly with sort of myself and my wife and our son, Colton. He was born just nearly 2 years ago in Hollis Street. And thanks to the early detection, sort of the newborn screening in Hollis Street, they were able to detect that he had had hearing loss from birth. And we had sort of a couple of rounds of testing in Hollis Street. And they could see sort of from with the new testing that he wasn't hearing the way you and I would have heard and things like that.
Okay,
and
so
from
that,
there, they were able
to... Sorry to interrupt you. So was that in the first couple of days immediately before you even left the hospital with Colton, is it?
Correct. Yeah, that's exactly it. So when he was just sort of freshly born and things like that and we're in a haze, there was doctors and nurses coming in and doing all their wonderful work. And unbeknownst to us, we didn't even know that they were conducting these tests. Like that new screening only came in 2013 nationwide. So without that test, we wouldn't know that Colton had hearing loss or was deaf from birth.
Okay. So they said to you then, while you were in the hospital with your beautiful newborn baby, look, there may be something here, but we're not sure.
Exactly, that's spot on. So we did the first round of testing. They sort of said, these results are inconclusive. So we came back a couple of days later for a second round of testing in the NMH. And then the second round of testing, similar to the first, were inconclusive. And they referred us to Grange Gorman, out to the Audiology Centre in Grange Gorman. And from there, Colton underwent more thorough testing, sort of where they would put sort of little electrodes on his head and then actually into or beside his ear, and it performed like a little clicking sound to see how he reacted or didn't react in Colton's case. And then the audiologist there was able to inform us that he was severe to profound hearing loss on both sides with his hearing.
Oh. And what was it like, Munro, getting that diagnosis?
Initially, it's a bit of a bombshell because we're first-time parents and we're all wrapped up in this excitement and high of bringing home your new baby and everyone's zooming and ahhing over him. And he was perfect in all sort of what he was doing and sleeping and not sleeping and going to the toilet and eating and all that kind of stuff. So we've no idea. And then to be told that, yes, he was deaf, it's a bit of a shock. But
the audiologist, the audiologist said something to you, I think, that really stuck with you, something really powerful.
Yeah, and really, really powerful. And it's sort of, she had said, Rachel was her name, she said, like, yes, it will be a bit of a shock, but bear in mind, guys, like, he's still the same little guy that you've brought in here, that you've loved and cared for the last few days and 5-6 days, and nothing else has changed about that. He is still the same little person. The only difference is now that you have the knowledge and the idea that you have the knowledge that he has the hearing loss and is deaf, and you can now equip yourself and learn to give him the best chance despite having the hearing loss.
Yeah, it's a really, really lovely way to look at it, isn't it?
It's brilliant. She was great. Like,
so where did you go from there then? What were the next steps to try and help Colton?
So he got his hearing aids. He got his first set of hearing aids at 2 months old. So he had this tiny little baby with a set of hearing aids. And even despite his hearing loss, we were told, and we lived by the idea of that eyes open, ears on. And the brain is exceptionally clever. And despite how minimal sound Colton was getting, the idea was that his outside world, for him, would have some sort of sound. And it was described to us, and I always think of it because there's an area where we live out in Rush. It's out along the cliffs towards the Martello Tower. And they said, if you imagine walking through a field of grass and you walk through it once, it leaves a little path. But if you walk through it 100 times, it's a furrow and that people can see from a mile away. And they said, that's the same way that happens with the sound waves that are going to the brain. So even if he's not hearing entire clarity. His brain is going, oh, that's a sound. Oh, that's a sound. So he was still getting some sort of sound to his brain, so that it wasn't a complete shock to him that the outside world had sound and had noise.
Okay, wonderful. Okay, so then he had the hearing aids, and as you say, that sort of helps him be aware of what's happening in the world in terms of the sounds. And then when he was one, or just after when he was one, he was fitted for the cochlear implant. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so Colton has a thing called Pendred syndrome, and that he had a small bit of hearing to begin with, but in a lot of cases with Pendreds, as they get older, the tiny bit of hearing he would have had can fade and actually result in nutting. So in conversation with some of the experts and things like that, were like, okay, do we stick with the hearing aids? Well, even with the hearing aids, we weren't entirely sure just how much sound he was getting.
Hmm.
And in regards to when we're going down the line of learning how to speak and just environmental sounds, we don't know what clarity he was getting on it. So the idea of the cochlear implant was to give him a much larger chance of hearing in a fashion that you and I would, and that he could hear speech and environmental sounds as well. And then from there, learn how to talk and speech and language and everything like that as well.
Okay.
He had the surgery for his cochlear implants on the 31st of March, 2025. And after that surgery, there's approximately 1 month of what they call darkness. So he has no hearing aids and the cochlear implant hasn't been activated at that stage. So he has zero sound whatsoever. And then, but in fairness to him, he did go quiet and he was a bit unsure, but he has a remarkable outlook on life, so he has. He's, despite not even being two yet, he is one of the most positive little fellas I've ever seen. I'm a little bit biased, but he is a cracking little fella, and he finds the good in every scenario that we ever go into. But a month later, on the 30th of April, at the age of 18 months, he got activated.
So what difference has that made then in all of your lives?
It's huge. He's, like I said, he's 3.5 months activated now. And at this stage, he's responding to his name. He's babbling at a lot of babble, a sort of pre-verbal, all the oohs and ahs and things like that as well. Responding to some of his little noisy books, whether it be an old McDonald tractor or a little bit of music. He loves music. So, you know, some of the books, you push a button and it gives you like a five second extract from Mozart or Beethoven or something like that.
Yeah.
When that plays, he'll be hopping up and down and bouncing to that. And then as soon as it stops, he'll push the button again to hear the sound. So his association to sound, since he's had the cochlear implant, has been so, so positive. It's been amazing.
And you are teaching him what different sounds are, is that right? So like if you press the doorbell,
correct,
you'll say, that's the sound of a doorbell. So go on.
Yeah. So how he hears now is very different to how you and I would hear. So when he hears a dog bark or the doorbell ring or something like that, it'll sound different for him because his hearing is now electronically stimulated through the cochlear implant, which is different to how you and I would hear. So what him and I do every morning, we do like a walk and tour of the house, and we'll start at the front door, we ring the doorbell, and apart from showing him, we'll narrate to him as well. And I'll be like, Colton, this is the doorbell. And we'll push the doorbell, we'll hear it ring, and it's like, oh, did you hear that? That's the doorbell.
Okay.
And then we'll go inside the door, we'll close the door, we'll pull up the handle, it's like, oh, now the door is locked. You go into the bathroom, you run the tap. Like, oh, Colton, can you hear? That's the tap running. So that's the toilet flushing. That's the press closing. That's the fridge opening, the microwave pinging, everything like that. It's a full narration of a walk around the house. Again, because how he hears the sound around him is different to how you and I will. So in time, he will learn, oh, yeah, that's the tap running. He won't hear it the way you and I do, but he will learn and develop, oh, that's the tap, that's the doorbell, that's the dog, that's the car, all those same things. But it's just at the moment, with the hearing being so new and hearing differently. This is their advice and sort of things we've been told that will really help him. And they are. Like, he's only 3.5 months activated. And like that, if there's a knock on the door, say he's sitting in his chair having his dinner, if there's a knock on the door, the head comes up and the eyes dart to the door, and then he kind of look at me, kind of goes, "Did you hear that? I think there's someone there."
Because like, I heard that. Isn't exactly. That just wonderful? That is
amazing.
And in terms of communication, then obviously, so you're clearly obviously speaking to him. But what about sign language? Is that something that you need then as well in the mix, or is that something that you've been doing?
Yes. So we have an amazing sign teacher called Teresa, and we'll be operating on a system which is assisted sign assist through the ISL, Irish Sign Language. And Clodagh and myself, Clodagh, my wife, and I are both learning sign language with Teresa, along with our nannies and granddads and aunties and uncles and nieces from time to time, jumping all in on the Zoom calls. So when we're talking with Colton and when we're doing our story times and things like that, we will sign alongside as best as possible those story books and things like that. And he himself, even though he's not even 2 yet, is now signing for certain items.
Brilliant.
So
okay.
It's like when he comes down in the morning and we walk into the kitchen, he'll kind of look at me and he's mouthing for food. So there's a particular sign that he has for food to the mouth. And even more specific, he's signing for a banana. He loves having a banana after his breakfast. So he'll have his breakfast and then he'll kind of look at you and do the letter B sort of rubbing on the side of your cheek is for a banana. And he's kind of looking at me doing the banana sign. I'm like, what? You want a banana? You've just had your breakfast.
He's getting on great, Munro, by the sounds of things. And I know that's really, really brilliant to hear that. It really is. And you're running the marathon in October and you're doing it with a bit of a difference to stand to, for want of a better phrase, to stand to Colton. You're running it with noise-cancelling headphones.
Yes, that's it. So 2 years ago, when Colton was only a couple of days old, I had done the Dublin Marathon. And this year, we're back again, but we're running it for, and this is in relation to what the guys were saying the other day and advocating for some of the charities and the services that are out there. There's a couple of charities, one in particular called Chime, and one, Our New Ears, it stands for, have been amazing to Clodagh, Colton and I in resourcing and signposting and direction and just tips and tricks on how to help someone with hearing loss or that is deaf. And so this year I'm doing the Dublin City Marathon, but I'm doing it with full noise-cancelling headphones in solidarity with Colton and other children and adults that may have been on this deaf or hearing loss journey.
Okay, well, that's wonderful. And thank you so much, Munro, for joining us. And the very best of luck in the marathon, running that. And all our best wishes to Colton and his own journey as well, himself and the rest of your family.
Cheers. Thanks a million for bringing it up as a topic.
Not at all, Munro. Yeah. Thank you. 51551 if you want to get in touch.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815.
Dan O'Neill is on the line. Dan, you're very welcome this afternoon.
How's it going, Sarah?
Not too bad now at all. It's a big weekend, isn't it, coming?
Well, it's a massive weekend because, of course, as everyone knows, Oasis are playing 2 nights in Dublin. And I think for a lot of people, Oasis weren't just a band. They were the band. They were really the sound of a generation. And I've loved Oasis since I was about 10 years old. The first interaction I had with the band was when I got a VHS tape called There and Then, which was, you know, it was a video of their various gigs in Main Road and other places. And I couldn't afford a lot of albums at the time, being only 10, because I spent most of my money on sweets and Beanos. So what I did was I put a tape recorder up to the telly and recorded those gigs into my Walkman. And funny enough, I think for a lot of people, holding a tape recorder up a TV is probably the only way they're going to get to hear Oasis in the gig, given the ticket prices.
We'll all be at Echo Park with our tape recorders. So you're standing there, you're 10, you can't afford the album, and you have your little tape recorder, press record.
Yeah, exactly. And so I was walking around the school thinking I was the bee's knees, listening to my own little Oasis gig in my head. And then a few years later, in the year 2000, Oasis come to Lansdowne Road. I had no tickets. I was 14. Again, pocket money spent on less cigarettes and alcohol, but sweets and Beanos. And I was standing outside listening to the music. And about halfway through the gig, a ticket tout approached me and he goes, "Son, do you want a ticket?" And of course I said, "No, sorry, I have no money." But lo and behold, he gave me two tickets and I couldn't believe my luck. So I did the most rock and roll thing in the world. I rang my mum and I said, "Mum, I'm after getting two tickets to an Oasis gig." And we went into the gig, and as I walked into the gig, I was a massive Beatles fan as well, because Oasis, you know, turned me on to a whole world of music. But as I walked into Lansdowne Road, Oasis were singing Live Forever, and there on the screen was a big picture of John Lennon, and a little tear shed from my 14-year-old eyes. It was a wonderful moment. And I mean, that energy, Oasis were, you know, a working-class band. They looked like lads you might meet in the shop. They had an Irish background. And I think they told a lot of young people, like one of their songs, Supersonic, says, "You've got to be yourself, you can't be no one else." You know, they were loud, raw, full of life. And I think that energy, that spark, it's never really gone away for people. They're a fantastic band.
Yeah, I can hear actually your passion for them. It's clearly, do you have tickets, Dan, for this weekend?
Well, I'll tell you what happened, right? So I knew that Oasis were going to make this big announcement. And I was saying to my wife, "Oasis are making a big announcement. I better get them back together." And she was like, "Oh, no, don't be daft." But then they did, of course, get back together. And the minute that happened, I found out, before the tickets even went on sale, I went online and I booked hotel rooms for Dublin because I live in Limerick, when the gigs were on. And unfortunately, then I didn't get tickets. I did eventually get offered a ticket on the website, but it cost about £500 per ticket.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, I saw Liam Gallagher in Thomond Park last summer and he did the whole Definitely Maybe album. So I was thinking to myself, do I really want to spend €450 a piece to hear Noel croon, you know, Little by Little or something, because
yeah,
I got the Oasis experience last summer. But at the same time, I mean, I wish I was going.
I wish you were going too, Dad. Well, that's the thing. You need to go back down to Croke Park and see if you can find that tout or another tout who's just going to give you two tickets. And you can call your mum. And in the two of you could go, you know. Listen, Dan, thank you so much. You might stay in the line maybe, because I think we've got some more fans coming up. Stay with us. 51551.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Dawn Finnegan's on the line. Dawn, what do you think when you hear this? Dawn, are you getting excited, Dawn?
I'm literally buzzing here. I mean, it's just like, it just sounds like the soundtrack of being a 90s kid, to be honest.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? You know, it's the soundtrack to our lives growing up, isn't it, Dawn? I'm right there with you, except I won't be right there with you. You're actually going to the gig, are you?
I am. I only got my tickets last night, literally last night. So it's been, I've been trying since last August to get tickets, and this week has been an absolute roller coaster of emotions. We've had so many close calls, but secured the tickets last night, and yeah, definitely going tomorrow night. So,
okay.
Literally cannot wait.
And you met Oasis when you were six?
I did. I was 6 years old. So it's a funny story. Obviously, their parents are Irish. So their dad has family in an estate in Drogheda called Ballsgrove. So that's where I grew up with my granny. So this is probably going back to maybe like 96, 97. So it was like Oasis were like peak at the time. And I remember I was about 6 years old and I was playing out on the green with one of my little pals from school. We were playing tennis on the green. And next thing, this big, massive black car pulled up and Liam and Noel got out of the car. And my friend said to me, "That's the men that sing Oasis." And I was like, "Is it really?" And she said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, we go over." So we toddled over to them and she said, "Excuse me, I love Wonderwall." And I said, "I love Wonderwall as well. I always hear it on the radio." And they were like, "Oh my God, kids, it's great to meet you. How are you?" And we had a little, they were lovely, had great time for us. And we had a little chat with them for a minute. And Liam was saying, "Stay out of trouble and be good." And Noel put his hand in his pocket. And he said, give me your little hand there. And he gave each of us a pound. Now, it was like punt at the time. Like, this was before we had euros or anything.
Big money.
We got a pound each. Big money for a six-year-old. We were thinking, oh, my God, we are loaded. So we pounced our way down to the shop, filled up on penny sweets, Banshee Bones. We had Taz bars, chomps, everything. We got a feast with this £1. And I remember going back to my granny. My granny was standing at the front door looking for me because I'd obviously wandered too far where she couldn't see me. And I'm coming back with my arms full of sweets. And my granny was saying, where did you get that? I said, the men that sing Wonderwall gave us a pound. And she's going, what? What? And as we looked tonight, we could see like there was crowds starting to form across the green where their aunt's house was. So word was spreading that Liam and Noel Gallagher were in Ballsgrove. So yeah, that was my claim to fame.
Okay, and you got your tickets then by putting out pleas on social media, is that right? And you had to go on a motorway for the first time in your life to get the tickets, am I right?
Honestly, like, I'd say people are sick of me this week. I'd say I've just been unfriended, unfollowed, blocked on social media because I'm putting out pleas all week. Like, please, does anybody have a ticket? Anybody have a ticket? So we had so many close calls with, you know, tickets that weren't tickets and then tickets that were gone and tickets that were insanely expensive. And one of my clients last night, she gave me a text and she said, listen, my friend is selling two tickets.
Okay, and you had to go on the motorway.
Where is she?
Well, Dawn, listen. Yeah, and I know.
I drove up the motorway and we got them.
I'm so delighted for you, Dawn, that you got them. And I'm so delighted for everyone else. I really am. I'm not bitter at all for everyone who has got an Oasis ticket. But I really am genuinely delighted for you, Dawn. And thank you for getting in touch with the programme.